6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Reports quoting residents and U.S. defense officials indicate the Islamic State defenders are using civilians as human shields in the defense of Mosul. President Obama Tuesday acknowledged the Iraqi Kurdish assault on Iraq's second biggest city will not be easy, but will be successful.
I'm confident that we can succeed, although it's going to be a tough fight and a difficult fight. There will be ups and downs in this process, but my expectation is that ultimately it will be successful.
A U.S. defense official says more than 100 U.S. troops are accompanying nearly 30,000 Iraqi and Kurdish Peshmerga forces in their push to take back Mosul. They claim to have already captured a dozen villages. Senior Kurdish official Hoshyar Zabari said Tuesday, speed is the key.
To avoid a major humanitarian exodus or complexities that nobody needs. So really nobody has a definitive time when it will end, but I think there is a clear understanding we should do it, not in a hasty way or a rushed way, but in a planned way, to do it as soon as possible.
Estimates of IS fighters in Mosul range from 3 to 5,000. The long-awaited offensive kicked off Monday and is backed by airstrikes from a U.S. coalition as well as units from Sunni tribal forces and Shia militia. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has signed a decree for his government to quit the International Criminal Court. It follows Parliament's overwhelming vote to leave last week. Earlier this year, the ICC opened an investigation into political violence that has gripped the nation since Mr. Nkurunziza announced his intention to seek a third term. It focused on allegations of killings, imprisonment, torture, rape, and forced disappearances. This is VOA News. Russian and Syrian aircraft have halted airstrikes on the rebel-held sectors of Aleppo as they prepare for a unilateral humanitarian pause Thursday in their assault to allow anti-government fighters, along with the sick and wounded, to leave. As for humanitarian efforts, Jens Lerke of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said a longer pause is important.
The announcement that we heard was for an eight-hour pause, but on consecutive days for more than one day. We have and we continue to call for a 48-hour pause. 48-hour pause. That is what we need. We also need it in order to prepare ourselves to actually do such operations.
The eight-hour pause in military operations is to last from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. local time Thursday. Moscow has been accused of engaging in war crimes in Aleppo. The Taliban has denied reports of secret meetings with Afghan government officials. The Guardian newspaper quotes anonymous Afghan officials and sources within the Taliban as confirming at least two interactions between the warring sides last month and early in October. U.S. spokesman Mark Toner Tuesday said negotiations are the only way to resolve the conflict.
We believe that a peace accord is really the primary or the only pathway to ensuring peace and stability long-term in Afghanistan.
A preliminary round of negotiations between the warring sides took place in Pakistan more than a year ago, but broke down after it was revealed that Taliban chief Mullah Omar had been dead for over 2 years. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta Tuesday took aim at the courts and other government agencies for undermining his anti-corruption efforts. Mr. Kenyatta told a televised gathering no issue has frustrated him more. He cited a backlog of hundreds of corruption cases in the courts. Last year, he warned that the corruption had become a national security issue. German Chancellor Angela Merkel hosts a meeting with the Russian, Ukrainian, and French presidents Wednesday in Berlin to try to reactivate the stalled Minsk peace agreements aimed at a political settlement in Ukraine. But President Petro Poroshenko Tuesday held out low expectations for the meeting, called on his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to do two things.
First, to withdraw the Russian occupation of troops and weapons. And second, to give up to us the control and the uncontrolled part of Ukraine and Russian.
The 2015 Minsk agreement has helped reduce fighting between the Ukraine and pro-Russian separatists in the east, but clashes have continued and efforts to reach a political settlement have stalled. The main opposition party in Democratic Republic of Congo Tuesday rejected a deal that keeps President Joseph Kabila in power in April. Until April 2018, the UDP has called it a flagrant violation of the Constitution, by which Mr. Kabila's mandate expires in December. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Today is Wednesday, October 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The DRC's main opposition coalition calls for a stay-home protest today, Wednesday, to force President Kabila to step down.
We have to continue to protest because, according to the Article 74, we have to stop anyone who takes power by force or maintains the power by violating the Constitution.
Arba Puella is a member of the main opposition coalition known as Rassemblement. Meanwhile, the United Nations is moving hundreds of peacekeepers to Kinshasa to help deal with a possible outbreak of violence. Malnutrition intensifies in northern Cameroon amid Boko Haram conflict. And the third and final U.S. presidential debate will take place tonight.
Over time, we've seen that the American elections and debates have been of exemplary. It's also good to take note of the fact that there can be faults, there can be shortcomings. And looking at the shortcoming, looking at the professional organization, that helps us to make ours better.
Abdoulaye Camara is the president of the Press Union of Liberia. He's here in the United States to observe the presidential debates. We will tell you what type of candidate Nevada voters are looking for, and anti-inflammatory drugs improve symptoms of depression. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the coalition of leading opposition parties, known as Rassemblement, has called for a nationwide protest today, Wednesday, to register its rejection of an agreement between President Joseph Kabila's government and a coalition of smaller opposition parties to move the presidential election scheduled for this year to April next year. The constitution calls for the president to step down at the end of his second term, which is December 19th this year. Meanwhile, the United Nations is moving hundreds of peacekeepers from the east of the country to Kinshasa to help deal with a possible outbreak of violence. Arba Puella, a member of the main opposition coalition known as Rassemblement, says the opposition will not accept anything that violates the constitution.
Only the constitution, which says in the 19th of December of this year, Mr. Kabila has to leave office. According to the Constitution, everything else is a pure distraction. We are calling for the implementation of the UN Council Reach 2277 for a credible dialogue to all out impress. What they did is just a private engagement.
But the Electoral Commission has said that it's not going to be possible, maybe for logistical reason, to hold the election this year.
Mr. Nanga, the chairman of Electoral Commission, is doing everything according to Mr. Kabila's willingness. You know, they have the opportunity to finish their enrollment in 3 months, but they're doing their best so that Mr. Kabila can stay in power. They had 5 years to prepare elections, but they didn't do it by purpose. So we can't follow them. The Constitution says that in the end of the second term, you have to leave. Even one day, you can't stay. So according to the Constitution, Mr. Kabila has to leave the power, and is what Congolese people is waiting for. We can't accept what the Electoral Commission is saying.
The Rassemblement has been holding protests. What happens now? Are you going to continue with the protests or what?
Of course, yes. We have to continue to protest because according to the Article 74, we have to stop anyone who takes power by force or maintains power by violating the Constitution, is what Constitution is saying in Article 64. We have to continue so that Mr. Kabila has to live according to the Constitution.
When is your next protest or rally?
Tomorrow we have what you call in French ville morte, a death city, so that nobody will go to work. No school, no job, everybody will stay at home. And after tomorrow, for the coming days, we'll have another rally to show to everybody that we can't accept what they did today. We can't accept the violation of our constitution.
A delegation from the International Criminal Court, the ICC, is currently in your country because of the violence that took place last month. Has the delegation met with members of the opposition, the Rassemblement?
Yes, they did it. And it's what you have to know is that when Mr. Tshisekedi, the president of Rassemblement, came, We had so many, many people to receive him. We didn't destroy anything. And when we had our meeting on the end of July, nothing was destroyed. When we organized our protest, policemen came and they began to shoot people. That's why you have violence. So we know that it's the government himself, he is organizing violence. So we want the international court to arrest and to have sanctions to punish all people who are preventing our country to have democracy.
It's so nice to talk with you again, Mr. Puella.
You're very welcome, sir.
Alba Puella is a member of the coalition of leading opposition parties in the DRC. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Japan has suspended its infrastructure projects in South Sudan until South Sudan's leaders restore peace and security to the country. The Japanese ambassador to South Sudan, Kiya Masahiko, says his government will resume the projects once there is stability in South Sudan. Tito Justin reports from Juba.
Japan suspended its 560-meter-long Freedom Bridge along the River Nile, due to be completed in 2018, and the Juba Water Project, which would have supplied clean drinking water to nearly 400,000 Juba residents, has also been suspended. Ambassador Masahiko says Japanese staff who have been working on the projects do not feel safe.
Due to security situation, many of the staff are not back to Juba yet. Therefore, the major infrastructure projects like the Freedom Bridge or the Juba Water Supply Project, they are suspended. When they could resume, that's a question.
Ambassador Masahiko says they will only resume when peace and security have been restored. The ongoing fighting and political crisis in Juba prompted Japan to also suspend construction of the Juba River Port and similar bridges across the country. Masahiko is urging the Kiir administration to cooperate with the United Nations mission in South Sudan to restore peace and welcome the 4,000-strong regional protection forces to the country.
We feel a good reassurance to ensure that Juba is safe. And for that to happen, we like to see good cooperation between the government and AMIS, and also the early deployment of the Regional Protection Force. And we've been waiting for that to happen.
The envoy says Japanese engineers and other personnel will only resume work in South Sudan when the protection force is deployed. The Japanese ambassador is calling on South Sudan's warring parties to resolve their differences peacefully.
Pieces are very important. And as I see, there are some troubles in the Equatorial region and some also in other regions. But I'm hoping that all the people who want peace do not resort to fighting or conflict, but just work hard for dialogue so that the people can live in harmony.
In August, the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan, Mary Catherine Pee, warned it would be difficult to convince her government or the United States Agency for International Development to provide more funding to the South Sudan if violence continues in the country. Japan has 400 soldiers in the country, which are part of the engineering unity serving under the United Nations mission in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Today's Wednesday, October 19th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Aid agencies are sounding the alarm about severe food insecurity throughout the Lake Chad Basin as a result of the Boko Haram conflict. Health workers at a refugee camp in the far north of Cameroon are struggling to respond to mountain child malnutrition. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Marua in northern Cameroon.
Five Nigerian refugee children are rushed to the hospital of the Minawawa refugee camp Monday. This month, 70 children have needed medical attention here. Nurse Irene Barga says all of them have arrived suffering from malnutrition, but the hospital has limited resources to treat them.
La plupart des personnes qui sont touchées perdent leurs repères. Et dès lors qu'ils perdent leurs repères, ils perdent aussi les soutiens qu'ils ont.
She says some take their children home and health workers lose track of them. She says the families are not able to provide enough food and malnutrition is making other health conditions worse. She told VOA about 3/4 of the cases the hospital sees are related to malnutrition. When the hospital is running short on supplies, she said staff can only give first aid. The Minawawa camp is home to more than 50,000 refugees, a majority of them women and children. This part of Cameroon was already grappling with high rates of chronic malnutrition, as much as 30% among children before the Boko Haram conflict arrived in 2014. The mass displacement, including the influx of refugees from neighboring countries, has only made the situation worse. Cameroon's Ministry of Public Health and the United Nations say more than 100,000 children in northern Cameroon currently suffer from acute malnutrition. Moki, Edwin Kinzeka, for VOA News, Marwa, Cameroon.
The third and final U.S. presidential debate will take place later tonight, Wednesday, in Las Vegas, Nevada, between Democratic Party candidate Hillary Clinton and Republican Party candidate Donald Trump. One of those who will be in the debate hall is Abdoulaye Camara, president of the Press Union of Liberia. He and others are here in the United States as international debate fellows invited by the National Democratic Institute and the Commission for Presidential Debates to see what they can learn from the debates that can be applicable to their respective countries. Camara says while U.S. presidential debates have always been good examples for other countries to emulate, a number of things in this 2017 presidential election do not seem ordinary. But he said Liberia and the other countries hope to copy and improve on whatever shortcomings there may be in this particular election.
And the first thing, one of the issues that have come up this time, they've been at a point where one of the candidates has already started questioning the neutrality of the debates. And that is rather strange. And that's been an issue of discussion with colleagues and other Americans I've spoken to. Another thing is there have been a lot more tension. Say, for instance, the last debate started with Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton not shaking hands. Of course, at the end of the debate, they went to shake hands, which I thought was positive. And like one of the colleagues have said to me, this is not the best debate you want to learn lessons from.
That's what I was about to ask you. Did you learn anything particular that you can take back to Liberia and apply to, because Liberia is having its election 2017.
What's going to be positive is that, and I'm not alone invited. There are people who are organizing debates from other countries. And around the third debate, there's going to be a seminar, and we will close the seminar the day after the debate. So we're going to be reviewing lessons learned and providing options and a recommendation about how to make those debates better. But of course, it's important to note that these are human nature. As much as we think, over time we've seen that the American elections and debates have been exemplary, it's also good to take note of the fact that there can be faults, there can be shortcomings. And looking at the shortcoming, looking at the professional organization, that helps us to make ours better.
Are people in Liberia following the U.S. Presidential election?
Certainly.
Do they have any particular interest in what's going on?
Yeah, certainly they are interested, and there are a lot of concern this time because a number of things do not seem ordinary in this particular election.
What do you mean?
Say, for instance, the Commission for the Presidential Elections, Presidential Debates, has always been seen as a nonpartisan body. But we have a case where on more than one occasion, a candidate has challenged the neutrality. So those are issues that have come up. And we use the Americans as a guide in our processes. But that should not allow us to go back, because we have to recognize that these are human processes and there can be failures. But we look at the shortcomings and see how we work upon them to make them better for ourselves.
You say you have organized debates before in Liberia. Have you organized a presidential debate?
Yeah, the press, you know, organized presidential debates in 2011.
And the candidates have been receptive. They have attended.
Yeah, candidates have been receptive. We have some shortcomings, though. Say, for instance, organizing a debate and having more than 5-10 candidates has not been very easy. And we've been thinking about how to work around it. But at the press union, currently in Liberia, the press union has formed a coalition with a number of other civil society organizations, and we are putting in mechanisms to ensure that the debate is actually issues focused and there's actually enough time. And to provide enough room, it means that we will not easily have 11, 12, 15 candidates. And how do we determine how we have lesser candidates? We will actually have to use a scientific process. So as part of the, we call it Deepening Democracy Coalition, the press, you know, is in with the Liberia Media Center, the Center for Transparency and Accountability in Liberia, the Liberia Women Media Action Committee, and the Center for Media Studies and Peace Building. We're going to run opinion polls to determine the issues. We've already ran the first poll, and the results are actually showing that the people in Liberia are interested in the issues. They will vote on issues. And so for us, that is very important.
Abdoulaye Camara is president of the Press Union of Liberia. He spoke with me here in our Washington studio. The third and final presidential debate is being held in Las Vegas, Nevada, home to the United States' famous casinos. During the 2008 recession, the state was hit hard with job losses and a housing crash. Nevada's employment growth was the lowest in the nation in 2009, but the economy is recovering, and many residents are cautiously optimistic about who will be the next president. Elizabeth Lee reports from Las Vegas.
The backbone of the Las Vegas casinos is in this room, the Culinary Workers Union Local 226.
I clean the slots machine, they clean public restrooms in the casino, or all over the casino and hotel floors. I pick up broken glass, wet spills.
Cynthia Salcido and these union members are making plans to make sure their voices are heard when all eyes are on Las Vegas for the last presidential debate.
It's a hard election, but I mean, I'm pretty excited with Hillary. Hopefully if she wins, we will have our first female president.
Salcido has two daughters. One of them is named Hillary. She says as a single mom, it's sometimes hard making ends meet, but it could be worse. More tourists are coming back since the recession days when Las Vegas was hit hard, says public policy professor Robert Lang.
It was over-reliant on tourism. And when the sort of fun ended in the last decade and people stopped spending freely on consumerism, then the crash happened. And it happened deeper here. There was a big loss, especially in construction employment, that never really recovered.
But Lang says the tourism sector is booming again. This mall near the casinos is indicative of how small businesses, such as Flip Flop Workshop, are thriving. In less than a year, the Build Your Own Flip Flop store has grown to two locations in Las Vegas, and it's looking to hire more employees.
We have approximately 20 employees total, but we're growing, definitely in this mall especially. We've seen new businesses that are coming from all over the world and the United States.
This room is pretty big.
Nevada's housing market is also bouncing back.
Now we actually see those boomerang buyers who actually lost their homes able to come back, actually get approved for a mortgage, and again, get that American dream right back, which is home ownership. Let's go back
down. Marcella Hattat is now looking for a new house. She says the economy is a big issue for her when choosing a presidential candidate.
I don't really like either one of them, but ideally I want the one that's going to make and put emphasis on making this country and the economy to make it stable.
The economy is also one of the main issues that drives Luis Espinosa's choice for president.
I think Trump is the better choice. Personally, I think the greedier and the more money that the business owner wants, common sense tells me he's going to have to open up more businesses. When he opens up more businesses, he's going to employ more people.
Lang says about 10% of Nevada voters are still undecided or are voting for a third-party candidate. He says with a strong union effort to get Democrats to the polls, more people in the state may vote for Clinton on Election Day. But no one is making a real prediction because Lang says this election has been so unpredictable. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Las Vegas.
Drugs that are used to treat a number of autoimmune diseases where the body attacks itself appear to work to treat symptoms of depression as well. The finding of a new study suggests that anti-inflammatories, as they are known, may eventually take their place alongside conventional treatments to help people with depression. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
An analysis of a number of drug studies involving people with autoimmune diseases, including psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, and Crohn's disease, found that participants with symptoms of depression were improved after the research ended. In autoimmune diseases, white blood cells are overactivated, and instead of simply attacking bacteria and viruses, the immune system assaults various tissues in the body as well. Anti-inflammatory drugs quiet the immune system by disarming cytokines, a protein that's a major player in the body's inflammatory response. A small amount of inflammation is necessary to activate the immune system to fight microbes. But Gollum Khandekar, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Cambridge, says too much inflammation is harmful.
Slow-burning inflammation that's circulating in our body can cause a number of physical and psychiatric conditions. So, for example, in brain, it could lead to increased risks of depression. Similarly, in the body, it could lead to increased risk of heart disease, particularly coronary heart disease such as stroke, myocardial infarction, or also type 2 diabetes and type 1 diabetes.
Frequently, people with autoimmune diseases, which include type 1 diabetes, often suffer from depression. It's thought that they're depressed because of their chronic illnesses. But the new study implies that inflammation alters brain chemistry, causing the psychiatric disorder. Unlike anti-inflammatory drugs, antidepressants work by restoring the proper function of brain chemicals called neurotransmitters. However, a significant number of people with depression do not respond to psychiatric medication. For the meta-analysis published in the Nature journal Molecular Psychiatry, Khandekar and colleagues looked at the results of 20 studies of people treated with anti-cytokine or anti-inflammatory drugs for their arthritis, psoriasis, and Crohn's disease. They found that individuals who reported symptoms of hard-to-treat depression before the study had a mild to moderate reduction in those symptoms afterwards, similar to the effectiveness of antidepressants.
And what they showed is that patients who were inflamed, so in other words, they had elevated levels of inflammatory markers at the beginning of the trial, so these patients had showed benefits from the anti-cytokine drug. And the higher the level of inflammation, the greater the improvement in severity of depressive symptoms.
Psychiatry has been called an art rather than a science because there are no tests to tell doctors which antidepressants will be effective in patients. The findings that anti-inflammatory drugs may ease depressive symptoms could lead to the use of a blood test for inflammation in people with depression. And anti-cytokine drugs could someday be used in patients with depression for whom other drugs have failed. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. At least 8 people, including 6 Somali government officials, were killed on Tuesday in a heavy al-Shabaab attack on Afgoya, a town 30 kilometers west of the Somali capital, Mogadishu. And that's it for this Wednesday, October 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a nice day.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. Some things change, some remain the same. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we look at the role of the Darfur Women Action Group in Western Sudan. We'll discuss what key issues the organization is tackling in Darfur. That's next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.